All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the How's My Hand Bath podcast. Some of you might recognize my voice. My name is Shaheen Nakhchivani. And if you listened to our podcast in the past, you would remember that I used to do a bunch of one-on-one interviews with PGA Tour players, other coaches, you know, caddies, the works. We did a lot of talking about different interesting things in golf to try to help you better your game. That type of show is going to be coming right back. So for those of you who enjoyed it, well, guess what? We're going to be shooting out a whole bunch of new episodes in 2023. It's going to be very exciting. I'm going to be bringing on two more hosts for future shows. You guys might remember my brother, Brandon. He's our business partner here at Nakhchivani Golf. He was a member of the previous version of our podcast. He would occasionally jump on with me on the Q&As and sometimes on the interviews. And then we have a completely new member. It's our friend, Matt. He was on one of our episodes in the past as well. He will be going forward. So I will let my brother jump in here because we're going to be discussing kind of where we're at with the new stages of our academy, the formats for the podcast episodes going forward and all of that. And then we can kind of jump right in.
Hello, both of you. It's nice to be back. Most of you, like Cheyenne said, remember me previously in our old version of the podcast as somewhat of Cheyenne's producer and kind of the man behind the scenes. I'm pretty excited to be back now with both of you, Cheyenne and Matt. Matt and I are going to have our own show that's kind of going to focus on golf and things that kind of happen around golf in a business sense. The way this show and this podcast evolved pretty much stemmed from the evolution of our studio. Cheyenne and I had a very small DIY build-it-yourself golf studio in Montreal where it was kind of a proof of concept. We wanted to see if we could build a golf academy without overspending and overreaching. And after 3 years in that tiny rundown 1980s dingy office building, we finally realized that that we needed to move.
First of all, I think you're completely underselling our space. Relax.
Like, it was a good studio.
I think it was pretty good. I personally think it was pretty good.
It was a good studio. We had a TrackMan set up. We had our own sim with the netting. It was like big ceilings. Everything was great. It was old and it was
only... We basically outgrew the space after 3 years.
Yeah. So we needed to move and that forced us to look at new spaces. We recently posted on our Instagram at Nakhchivani Golf kind of a walkthrough of what our new space looks like. So if you're curious to see what our new space looks like, you can go check out there. It's pinned on our first post. So basically we moved and that brought us to a 5,000 square foot studio where we were able to build three TrackMan bays, bring in more coaches, build a little cafe, have a gym, have more of a performance center, kind of realize a little more of what our golf academy was as our dream.
Basically a massive upgrade to the space from what Brandon just referred to as a dingy do-it-yourself location.
Yeah. Well, that place was a proof of concept and it worked. And it's really what we needed to get our project off the ground. And Matt's been a friend of ours for a long time. Matt and Cheyenne go way back to meeting on the driving range. Matt and I go way back to meeting at his shop that he had in Montreal where he was selling some of the coolest stuff you could possibly find. And I think Matt got a little addicted to our studio and, you know, hanging around pretty much too many hours every day kind of gave us the idea of bringing him in on this podcast.
I will say one thing about Matt. I think between the three of us, obviously me and Brandon are heavily involved in the golf industry from a coaching side and just, you know, in terms of the services part of the game. I think that Matt is way more heavily involved on the opposite side of it, meaning as a fan, sharing very insightful opinions on how things could be better. I think Matt spends more time doing more research in that regard than me and Brandon probably combined.
I think what you're trying to say is that Matt's the biggest golf nerd.
I think Matt is a huge golf nerd,
hands
for sure.
Down, easily.
And I think Matt would be the perfect addition to the pod for that exact
So without continuing to just talk about him, Matt, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, guys. Super happy, super pumped that we're starting this, finally. We've been talking about it for a while. My name is Matt. I coined How's My Hand Bath.
You did, actually.
Oh, my God. That
the
is
name
so
of the podcast comes from
Matt. I completely forgot about that.
Matt
is actually the one who gave us that name.
Yeah. Coined it on a tee box.
And I promised you I'd use it, and we did.
Yeah, you did. And, you know, I've been around the Nakhchivani brothers for a while. I was a big fan of the first studio, by the way. I thought it was a good little...
it was kind of like a hideout, you know, like it wasn't so much of a hangout space. It was kind of like a place to hide away. Like it was,
I think you guys really
had no idea that building had a golf simulator
that I think so highly about.
Guys, that place was the lab.
Yeah, it was the lab.
It was the initial lab.
Yeah.
I think the reason I have the feelings I have is mainly because, I don't know, like as the business manager, I always wanted to build this big studio, like big sign. And it was just the opposite of that.
You just got to get there.
It definitely was not that. Yeah, we took baby steps.
I mean, we got there in 3 years. I'd say that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, but look, I think we all came up golfing on dog tracks and we all appreciate what that was. And that's just a step,
right? You mean golf UFO for the Montreal listeners.
Free ad. Talk about dog tracks. Yeah, so Matt joined us, and now Matt, like you were saying, you coined the name, well, and it was your idea actually to kind of split the show into two.
Well, I just think that there's a lot of shop talk that always happens between all three of us and other friends of the studio and stuff, and I think that a lot of it's super interesting, and a lot of it is just totally made up bullshit, and you know, like a lot of the other content that I consume, I think it's good. I think it's worth a listen. It's worth putting it out there. And, you know, we spent a lot of time working in and around this game that we all love to a certain extent. And, it's just fun to be able to share it, you know? I mean, it's the first podcast I thought was great. I was an avid listener. And I just thought that, you know, there was a potential for more, just more content coming out of it. I thought we left a lot on the table.
Yeah, I agree. I think so many times we were having conversations at the cafe at work and like, I don't know, just any topic, you jumping in, sometimes some of the guys around, like you were saying, like Matt or Tam or whatever, like we're just talking and it's like, man, we should talk about this on the podcast, or like the funniest conversation ever. And it's like, how come we don't talk about this on the podcast? And like Shine was saying earlier, we had a hiatus for a long time. And the biggest reason was the studio. We put a lot of focus and energy in there and we didn't want to come back on the podcast and make a bad show.
And may I add, it's a really, really nice studio.
Thank you.
It's when you guys told me you guys were moving and you were gonna build a bigger facility, like I didn't think that's what it was gonna end up being. Like it's a cool, special place, and it started to like build its own vibe. Like it's taken on its own little spot. You know, it's people hang out, people work on their game, people socialize. Like it's a great addition to the Montreal golf scene.
I appreciate that. It's it was definitely a vision of Shine and I's to have something that's a little different. A lot of spots here in Montreal and in Quebec in general are more, it's either like a very high-end performance studio at a golf course, which is very small, you know, tailored to the one or two coaches that are there. There's no real like hangout vibe. There's no accessibility. It's kind of private. And then the opposite end of the spectrum, you have like bars with really shitty Sims in them, and it smells like beer, and the lights are low, and the Sims don't catch anything.
It's not really the right environment for learning. It's more of like a play center.
There was no like, you know, fun place where you can also do some serious golfing. And so I think that was kind of the idea that we had. We grew up, you know, culturally Italian, Shine and I. So we also had this like Italian cafe, like desire to build into the studio, which I think we achieved, you know, like
Brandon's first purchase for the new facility was the coffee machine, by the way.
Very important. Listen, a good conversation always starts with a good coffee.
Literally a high-end espresso.
So if you don't have a good coffee, you can't have good conversations. That's my opinion.
Hey, you know, the cafe culture, I mean, it's...
Especially here.
For anyone who's ever been to like a proper social club, like an old Portuguese or Italian or any, you know, any type of like, you know, little espresso bar, like it's a thing. It's
a vibe.
It's a coming of bad opinions and hot takes and complete bullshit, you know,
which
and
we are now transforming into the second show of the pod.
What you all want to hear, just the conversations that come out of the cafe.
Put it this way, like kind of just to piggyback off of what Matt said, I think the first version of the podcast is really good. And I know a lot of you love the fact that it's very informative. And obviously you can learn about the golf swing and I can talk mechanically about that stuff for hours, as you guys probably already know from the past. But I think that just a discussion on the current state of the game and just, you know, talking a whole bunch of nonsense and things that are very important to discuss could be really fun too. And I think that we all share very valuable opinions. Obviously, me and Brandon very heavily invested in the golf industry. I think our opinion carries some good weight. And like I said, Matt, with his extensive knowledge, also has a very good opinion on it. So Yeah, that's pretty much it. So if you guys want to jump right in, I mean,
I was going to say, without talking about this podcast more, let's start talking about something real.
16 minutes later.
Yeah. What was the first segment, Matt, you wanted to jump into? You had a pretty good one before.
When we were talking about before we were setting it up?
Yeah.
Well, to get to it real quick, about a week ago, when we were all talking about the podcast, Shane mentioned that he had seen this, I'm not sure where he saw it, probably on Twitter, but his question was, who's the best golfer from the 70s to present, not named Woods or Nicholas? And I was just saying that I've been thinking about it the whole week, and I was just saying how it became this whole thought process, and I wanted to just spew it out like I always do when I run into these guys, but then they both stopped me and said, you know, keep it for the pod. So to get into it, when Shane first brought it up, my initial thought was Rory. Unapologetically, huge Rory fan, but I think that's a little recency bias. So then I started thinking about it, and you know, obviously I Googled some stuff, but then my thought went to Vijay, but then I was like, well, that can't be it. And then I eventually settled on Tom Watson. So, you know,
here's my question, is that what's your definition? So we were saying the best golfer of all time, not named Tiger or Jack, right?
Right.
So, like, looking at the list of wins in majors,
of all time, from 1970 onward.
Yeah, okay. 70s to present.
Yeah.
Well, like, take out like really, really old school golfers that either had very small fields.
Yeah.
It wasn't as competitive as it is now, as I'm sure everybody would agree with. But also just the fact that, like, the reality is most people who are alive today and have an opinion on this stuff probably haven't seen those golfers from pre-1970 even play.
Well,
so it's hard for us to have a serious opinion on those golfers.
You automatically remove Ben Hogan, you remove Arnold Palmer, you remove Byron Nelson, you remove so many big names, I think, that are, like, in terms of, like, talking about an all-time golfer would have been different. So if the case is after 1970...
I mean, there's like 5 to 10 golfers that you can put on that list that I think you can make a case for every single one of them. I would love to hear Matt's case for why he thinks it's Tom Watson personally.
Well, again, I mean, it comes down to how you qualify these things, but I'll just assume that we're going to qualify it the way that I see it, which is Tom Watson. He has 8 majors, total majors. The only people that have more than him in the relevant era is Gary Player and then obviously Woods and Nicholas. But my main thing is that he's won 5 opens.
Yeah, that's pretty hard.
5 opens. You know, and to me, the Open it's my favorite major. Unapologetically, favorite major across the board. I don't care where they
are. Here's my concern is that are we defining the best golfer as the one who won the most at, like, historic venues or a certain type of major championship, which, you know, golf was created in Scotland. Like, we get it. That's the most, let's call it, natural or organic form of golf to this day. Is that what we're defining it as the best? Because you can also make a case for the fact that, like, yeah, okay, he won a lot of Opens, but he also didn't win that many of the other majors. Like, he's only won 2 out of the other 3, right? He never completed the Slam, never won the PGA, only won the US Open once. So, like, over 50% of his majors really was at one type of
fair golf. Enough, but he won the US Open at Pebble, chasing Jack.
And we all know how that went down. If people remember, like, the famous shot from the side of the green
from 15. Yeah. I mean, you know, that open alone is one of the great opens of all time.
To play devil's advocate, as much as I don't want to in this scenario, what's the take on Phil?
Because okay, Phil, well, first of all, if we're going to have this conversation, you need to completely get rid of any sort of, like, bias. Live mentality of recent situations that have occurred. Like, consider it as in Phil Mickelson, up until the pandemic
majors.
Or up until his most recent major, like, where do you rank him on this list? Because people are going to have biased opinions on him based on, like, the whole situation that happened with the LIV and him leaving. In my opinion, if you want to have a serious conversation on this, like, you got to remove that factor. Like, remove Phil Mickelson, the human, and the decisions he's made most recently, whether you agree with them or not, and talk about Phil Mickelson, the golfer. I mean, 6 majors, 45 PGA Tour wins. Like you said, very few golfers have won as many majors as him.
In my opinion, it's almost Tom versus Phil. Mainly because,
I mean, oldest golfer ever to win a major most recently. Like, I mean, he has got to be up there. Obviously choked a couple times at the US Open, in my opinion, where he should almost have more majors. But it's easy to say that in hindsight. Like, you can say that about almost anyone. I mean, how many times has Greg Norman failed to win the Masters because he couldn't finish, you know?
How many guys on this list lost the tournament by 1 or 2 stupid strokes? But I would almost say it's really a question of, and people might hate me for this, but it's really a question of Tom versus Phil. I think Rory kind of falls into the recency bias. He's young. He hasn't finished his career. Whereas I feel like Phil is at the tail end of his career, most definitely. Maybe Rory, once it's all said and done, is going to have that title of best golfer of all time after anyone named Jack and Tiger. But I think right now you look at total numbers, which matters. And I think you're looking at Tom or Phil. I mean, Phil, like you said, 45 wins, a little bit more than Tom, 6 majors, fair, not 8. So
fair, but there's also more golf tournaments now than there was in the 80s and the 90s.
Yeah, but you could make a case that the fields are deeper and they're harder to win now, too.
That's fair. That's also true.
So, like, what? Now we have to take standard deviation into consideration. Well, no, like,
you could almost, like, if you want to simplify it, offset the fact that, like, yes, there's more tournaments, but fields are also more difficult. That kind of balances out.
Fair enough.
Clubs are more easier to play today than they were back then.
And I think...
We're just opening up a can of worms right
exactly,
now.
Exactly, so...
No, but I think, like, this is why these discussions are so... I find them fun, but... controversial. So
let's take a final vote on each.
Well, no, because Brandon is saying it's Tom versus Phil, and then like Rory's recency bias. But you got Vijay Singh, you have Ernie Els. Now, okay, I think somebody ran through the numbers. I remember reading it on Twitter or something once, and it was like, if Tiger Woods doesn't exist, I think Ernie has the most majors. Like more than anybody else, he has finished second. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe I remember reading like, Ernie finished second to Tiger more than any other golfer and would have won who knows how many more events if Tiger doesn't exist. You know, like Vijay obviously smashed 2004. Like that was his huge year.
That's a tough take to say though, because I feel like the fact that Tiger did exist elevated everybody's game. A lot of people changed the way they played golf.
I mean, Phil has been outspoken about that numerous times, that Phil probably isn't Phil without Tiger being Tiger.
And so, I'm sure Ernie maybe deep down might say the same. I mean, you when Tiger's game came to golf, I think it changed the way a lot of golfers play golf. Especially the pros. I mean, you see a lot of them, especially around the time that he started physical training and a bunch of other things, especially with the way that he hit the ball.
But those are all, again, those are all like, that's what qualified what he brought to the game. When he really brought
the Tiger effect.
But what he really brought to the game as far as a strategic thing is that he changed game management. Like
there's a whole system based on Tiger's
right. Well, he went against conventional wisdom for managing a golf course that essentially changed how everyone does it now.
You know what's more impressive than that is that I don't even know if Tiger was ever aware
that he
consciously
was even doing
that he was making those decisions.
Fair question. I mean, you know,
I actually don't think he does. Like, if you actually go back and talk to people who have known Tiger, and obviously I'm in the coach's circle, so I know people who have discussed at length like swing and golf stuff with Tiger or around Tiger. I don't think he was conscious about a lot of these things. I think it was just innate in him to aim at a certain location, play certain shots, make certain decisions.
But when you say conscious, you mean like you don't think that
he
realized it was a system?
Exactly. Like he wasn't sitting there deliberating like, should I aim here or should I play more aggressive aiming there or should I do this?
No,
I should just play a shot to here.
I think he just knew
with this club in my hands. And
I know that aiming here is going to give me the best result.
Obviously, to some extent, I'm sure there was some deliberation many times, but I don't think like in his mind, he was like, I'm going to play this type of way today. It was just like the Tiger way was just in his mind, you know?
Yeah, no, I think he just had the undeniable urge to win, right?
Yes, but I think what Shine is saying is more like he didn't think he was playing a system, but he was so goddamn talented that his decisions were so consistent.
Right, no, I think
it actually... It actually allowed someone else to discover the system.
Right. Well, I mean, I think those are all products of how good he was. Like he was such a consistent ball striker that you could.
He just indirectly created a system.
Right. You could notice patterns just by watching him.
Sorry to cut you guys off. For 15 straight years or something like that, Tiger never finished outside of sixth in strokes gained approach.
It's bananas.
We went from a question about who's not named Tiger and Jack, and we ended up talking about Tiger for 5 minutes.
That's because Tiger is Tiger.
Yeah, exactly. But let's get back to that last question just so that we can move on. What's your final vote
best?
I'll give mine. I'll start. Sure. I'm going to say Phil. I'm going to say best golfer since 1970, not named Tiger or Jack, is Phil. And you can rip me in the comments. Tell me why I'm wrong. Be my guest. I would love to hear you why you think so. But in my opinion, the number of wins, the number of majors that he's put up, even most recently, love him or hate him, the guy hits the ball and he's won. So that's my take. Shine?
I mean, I think as of right now, this current moment, I would have to say it's Tom Watson. And I'm not even a huge Tom fan necessarily. But I think for his accomplishments and who he went up against and what he achieved, I have to say it's Tom. I think by the end of his career, I think Rory will make a case for it. Obviously, it's way too early to say now. He's not old enough. He hasn't competed nearly as long as Tom has. I think Rory is an exceptional ball striker. I've seen it in person. He's an incredible golfer. And I think Rory's A game is far better than most golfers, even to this day. Which is why when, like, you know, it's almost like Rory's ability to win when he doesn't have his A game is what's going to separate him over the long term, in my opinion. For what he's accomplished up until this point, obviously Rory's too young. I think it's Tom Watson.
I'll just do one more quick take before Matt gives his answer. The reason I say Phil is not only because of his numbers, but because of his numbers during Tiger dominant era. Like, you talk about Ernie Els, how many potential second place finishes he had that would have been wins. Like, Phil put up 45 wins in six majors when Tiger was at his all-time best. He still managed to pull out 45 wins.
Fair enough. But Tom Watson did it when Jack Nicklaus.
Exactly. So we're kind of saying the same thing.
Right. And again, like...
Who's the second best?
By the way, Ernie Els shot, what, like 30 under at the Tournament of Champions and lost at Kapalua? Like, that's ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, to wrap this up, obviously, I'm choosing Tom Watson for obviously the numbers are the numbers. I mean, that's
pretty just interesting.
I feel like our opinions can flip flop too fast.
Right. Those two fair points. Enough. But to me, what tips me over the top, and I'm not a big Phil fan, but I won't take that away from him as being a real stick, because he obviously is. I just, as a fan, being a fan of golfers, I just watch old Tom Watson. You can watch his championships. You can watch the US Open at Pebble. You can watch the stuff he's done at the Open. I just like him as a golfer. I like him. He's an entertaining athlete. He's got a beautiful swing. He's got a great short game. Like, I don't know, man. I don't know. Tom Watson, for sure.
Okay. We have two more of these interesting questions that I would love to jump into.
Sure.
The first one is, and we were just kind of discussing this before we jumped on the pod, who is the current active most underrated golfer on the PGA Tour? And if you had to choose one all time, who would that golfer be? And I can share my thoughts while you guys jump into your research and just think it through. If we are talking all time, I kind of have to jump on the bandwagon of a lot of people that have said this on the internet. I believe it is Billy Casper. I believe Billy Casper, because of the fact that he only won three majors, always gets overlooked for everything. But the guy won 51 times on the PGA Tour. He is seventh all time in PGA Tour wins. He's never ranked in the top 10 of any category that I've ever seen. He's barely ranked in the top 20 or 25 of any category I've ever seen. He's never mentioned as among the greats. He's never even remotely considered among the greats. But yet he won 51 times during an era where he was competing against Ben Hogan, Arnold Palmer, Jack Nicklaus, and so on. I mean, 51 wins on the PGA Tour over a span of 20 years. That's 2.5 PGA Tour wins for his career per year. Against the best golfers ever with less amounts of tournaments per year, quantity-wise. Yes, he only won three majors. Obviously, given his amount of total wins, it's very disappointing if you consider the ratio. And I think, in my opinion, that's why a lot of people don't consider him. But how is it that Byron Nelson is looked so highly with only one more win and only two more majors, and Billy Casper is nowhere to be found on that list? Now, obviously, you can make an entire conversation on, like, well, what do you define as the most... what was the way that we phrased the question?
Underrated golfer.
The most underrated golfer. How do you define underrated? Well, for me, the way I would define the most underrated golfer is one who is not talked about in the same light as others. One who is not given their form of credit, their due credit. And I believe that
Billy Casper
is at the top of that list. If 13 we're talking
more wins than Tom Watson.
Sorry, what did you just say?
13 more wins than Tom Watson. Just putting it up.
13 more wins than Tom Watson, and you guys are saying Tom Watson is the best golfer from 1970. Like, just to say, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's. I think this is another question that's tough to answer because of our age and the amount of golf we've witnessed and seen in our life.
Keep in mind, I'm going purely off just numbers here.
Yeah, so like looking at the numbers, it's. I don't know. I feel like I'm flip-flopping between, and I don't know if this is the right way to kind of identify them because they are very well-known golfers, but like probably Faldo or Vijay. I mean, Faldo has, what, six majors? People don't ever consider him in any top 10 list. For golfers, six majors is a lot.
Yeah, that's up
there. And he also put Norman to shame at the Masters. Yeah,
how many times?
Norman crumbled, yeah.
I think at least twice.
He won, so like, I believe he won three. I could be wrong.
So I'd probably say Nick Faldo.
Yeah. Those are both good ones, to be honest. I just struggle when you say underrated, you know? I spend so much time just like reading about golfers and stuff. And to me, like,
Matt's going to pull up some like, well, I read a story somewhere where Billy Casper was an asshole.
No, not, so I'm at not all. Put not at all. No.
Matt's going to come out and say like Lee Trevino or something.
Yeah, he's going to say something that no one's thinking.
Okay, are you ready? Are you
First
ready?
First of all, Matt was about to say Tiger before, yeah. And I'm pretty sure he's going to put Tiger as the most underrated golfer
ever, Tiger Woods.
No, I mean, that's just like a devil's advocate way of saying
Tiger's like, so good, he gets every accolade ever, including the underrated.
No, but how do you define this stuff? But since I'm just going to pull a hot take here just because Hal Irwin.
Hal Irwin. Yeah. Okay, tell us why Hal Irwin is the most underrated golfer ever.
By the way, most Champions Tour wins, I think, still to this day, right?
Yeah, and he has three majors. He's got 20 PGA wins. Hal Irwin was also, I mean, he was a full-time professional golfer, sort of. Like, you know, he was a bit of a playboy. He was, you know.
Here's the deep dive research that we were waiting for.
No, look, it's a bit of a hot take. I know he's probably not... I just struggle with underrated. Hey, man,
more wins and more wages than Greg Norman and Ernie Els.
I struggle with most underrated because, you know, to me, a lot of these players are players that they're all great. You know, whether you look at Trevino or, you know, like Billy Casper, like they're bananas, like 50 wins. Come on. Like,
let's go way back. Tommy Armour.
Yeah. No, but even like Lee Trevino could be a decent hot take. Like, obviously, a lot of people talk about Lee Trevino because his personality was bigger than his game. But, like, you know, 29 tour wins and six majors.
If you're going to play the devil's advocate card for Tiger, I think he would fall more under the category of, like, who underperformed the most in their career. Like, you can make a strong case for Tiger and the whole thing of, like, if he doesn't change his swing, if his body doesn't get beat up, if he doesn't have kind of the background personally that would have stories that came out. Like, Tiger could easily have won 120 PGA Tour wins.
I mean, think
like
about it. Tiger changed his swing three times.
And still came back and won majors, by the way.
Like, at the height of his career, he had a wholesale swing change.
Yeah, that's why it's one of those things where it's like, it's easy to say this in hindsight. Maybe he doesn't change his swing and maybe he never wins another major. Like, you don't know. How many times have we seen golfers, like, spike in terms of performance for, like, a 2 to 4 year period and then completely disappear? I mean, that's happened a bunch. Rory won all his majors over a 3-year span. I mean, Brooks Koepka won all of his majors over a 3-year span. Like, this happens a lot.
Spieth.
One of my favorite.
Jordan Spieth won all his majors over a 3-year span. This happens more often than you think.
One of my favorite Tiger stats is he has 40 career wins on the European Tour, which is
they're basically third, all WGCs and majors.
But still, he has 40 wins on the Euro Tour, and that's third all time. Or the Euro
and
Tour.
He's never played a full season on the
European Tour, but yet he has the third all-time most.
Well, because
wins.
Like I said, I think it's all WGCs and majors.
I mean,
that fall into
like
that
there's a list of like 1,000 Tiger stats and records.
Should we just do a Tiger pod?
I mean, this is going to become
okay.
One.
Okay. So let's change direction a little bit. Let's talk less about like golfers and stuff. I want to jump into the whole situation with Xander this past week.
I'll let you guys start that one off.
Yeah. So obviously, for those of you who are you know, big avid watchers of the PGA Tour, Xander basically hit a tee shot. He was behind a tree. And by the way, when I share my thoughts and opinions on these conversations, I completely exclude the golfer for who they are. I want to make that very clear. I'm very heavily invested in the professional side of golf. When I share my opinions on these things, I'm never going to take into consideration who the golfer is, or I will do my best to limit that as much as possible. I'm strictly talking about the scenario. Whether it was Xander, whether it was Rory, whether it was Nick Taylor, it does not matter. I'm just going to share my opinion on the actual scenario at hand, and I'll try to not be biased about the golfer itself, okay? Because I'm a huge Xander fan, don't get me wrong. And Xander's a Callaway guy, I'm a Callaway guy, I love it. I'm just going to take the situation at hand. Xander hits a tee shot behind the tree. Now, if you're in this situation, his feet were sitting he was basically completely stymied behind the tree. Like, he had no outs for the most part, right?
He's inches from the tree.
Yeah, like, he would have basically had to punch out. Like, there's no way he could have advanced his ball that much. So, he tries to take his stance. He realizes that his feet are in animal holes, like holes that were dug from, what do they call them? Like, a burrowing hole from an animal. And so, he calls the rule official in. First rule official denies his request to get a free drop. Calls in a second rules official. Second rules official gives it to him. Okay.
Man, so, I have a question already there.
Okay, so I have a couple of different things I want to discuss, and then I'll let all of you guys jump in, but I want to share my thoughts first, okay? To me, you hit your ball offline. Everybody talks about playing it as it lies. What is the difference? I know what the actual answer to this question is, but I'll talk about like why is it important, okay? What is the difference between hitting your ball behind a tree and having your foot in an animal hole where you are going to be much more likely to be sitting into those types of holes with your feet when you are offline, because that will never happen in the fairway or in like the rough, or at least like the rough within proximity of the fairway? What is the difference between this exact scenario that just happened and if somebody hits their ball next to a water hazard, you're on a mound, and now you have to be standing with your feet in the water to hit the shot because they're never going to give you a free drop there when your feet are in the water with an awkward lie with the ball overhanging next to a water hazard, right? Like, think about that type of scenario. They'll never give you the free drop there, but your feet are in a water hazard on an awkward position, whereas now you hit your ball offline behind a tree. Your feet are in an animal hole, which again, you hit the ball offline. You are being penalized by that. Now, if it's dangerous for you, I get it. Like if the hole is severe, there's a lot of subjectivity involved in that. I understand. But like you're talking about a tiny little animal hole. His feet would not have been in an awkward position that much.
Well, what you were saying, you know the answer. What is the answer?
Well, the answer is like if you're in this situation and you're in Xander's shoes, you are 100% taking advantage of the fact that the rule allows you to do that. So no blame at any point for people who are being frustrated online should ever go to Xander because you would do it.
His job is to take advantage of the
rules. I
would do
it, and every single person who's listening to this or has played around a golf would take advantage of that situation.
But any golfer...
The issue lies with why does the rule allow
us governing body of the
take advantage of that type of situation?
My question was when you first described the situation that he called over a rules official, the rules official denied his request, and then he called a second rules official. Why
should he have ever been entitled to a second rules official when he was initially denied it?
That's my question. Is like you look at any other sport, like for example, football, right? You have coaches' challenges in hockey, you have coaches' challenges. Like, I get the challenge here is that he wasn't sure about what he's allowed to do, so he calls over a rules official. He's not satisfied with the answer. Why is he allowed to call a second rules official?
Well, I think the issue is that it's not that he wasn't sure what to do. I think all these pros who play pro golf in the PGA, they're obviously all want to win. They're all going to try to win. But they all know, like, if you take Xander out of this and you put Patrick Reed in his place, the outrage would be obviously amplified, but with the similar grief, the similar gripe. I think, I don't blame the player at all. I wouldn't even blame Patrick Reed for doing it. What I think is problematic as a whole, if the governing body wants to not have this, but I'm not convinced that they do, is that they need to enforce the rules that are already on the books. Like, this isn't a new rule. It's not a clarification of a standing policy. Technically he shouldn't have had relief.
Okay. Which is what the first rules official said.
Right.
If I'm going to play devil's advocate to this entire scenario, right, and I'm on the other side, sure. I don't believe he should have been given relief.
Right.
But I'm going to play the other side just for a second. There's too much subjectivity in the sense of like, what do you define as like a dangerous stance for his feet if the hole is too deep or not? Like, how do you even define that? Now, if he's going to be given a free drop, should he still be behind the tree? How do you define that? Like,
What was the grounds that the second official allowed the relief? It was on what grounds?
Okay, so I don't know because nobody will ever know unless you're in that actual situation.
They didn't publicly say
but
why.
But here is a conversation that someone put up online, and it's somebody who's a golf analyst who said this, and I read it on Twitter and I really liked it. Okay, is how much of the second rules official allowing it? How much of that is based on the fact that they just don't want to say no to the tour player because there's going to be too much backlash? It's going to come back to this tour official, right? And it's like, to some extent, they're probably afraid to answer back to these players with the fear of losing their job. Like, there's so much that goes into like the second rules official saying yes if you actually think about it on a deeper level.
Right, but this is such a tiny part of a much bigger topic. Like, the PGA doesn't have a rules official that follows every group. That to me is insane. How do you not have a group of officials following every group, especially on a Sunday, afternoon, right? So then the first rules official, just by reading online, apparently this was his first time being an official at the Waste Management. The second one had been there a lot. Apparently he was more familiar with the course and the tournament and stuff, and whatever, read into that what you will. The real, to me, I just think that, you know, whoever controls the rules official doesn't give them the agency to say no to the players, and the players are, you know, they're used to being able to push for their own outcome, right? It's kind of like that time Bryson wanted relief and the first official said no, the second official said no, and he called in the third official, and the third official finally said yes. Like, where does it end? I don't know. I mean, I think the real discussion is the will, does the powers that be, do they want, is this a problem or is this not a problem? I mean, that's the real conversation.
I think there should be a system where if you're going to take advantage of the rules and you're absolutely certain that you're correct, then you should like have skin in the game. In a sense, in hockey, just for as an example, if a coach challenges a play and he's wrong, he loses a timeout.
Right, but I think the...
What are you going to do, add a penalty stroke to a player who calls in rules official and gets denied?
No, not the first one. But if you call a second rules official and he backs the first one, then maybe you get a stroke.
Yeah, but
because
I don't...
Because now it's two times you wasted
time. I don't think
time.
You should be entitled to call in a second rules official after the first one denied it. Well, I think it should be over.
But I don't even...
I agree with
especially
you.
If we're trying to speed up play here. How long did it take him to call in the second... Like, I don't know, but yeah, like you're talking about so much added time here.
But the thing is like...
But that's my point, is that you're going to discourage golfers. You're going to discourage these pros from calling a second official. That if they're so certain that they're right and the officials are wrong.
Just use your foot wedge. No one's watching. Imagine.
But I think the rules as they are right now would have eliminated all controversy if they would have been applied.
Okay, so Matt, you seem to have a better understanding of this actual rule than most. And golfers on the PGA Tour don't have great understandings from my experience with all of the rules.
Well,
so
maybe they don't.
How would this rule actually have been defined properly?
Well, I think A, I wasn't there and I just saw it on TV, so I can't. But the as per the rules official, in theory, the rules official that was there has to judge is him standing where he needs to stand to hit the shot, is it impeded by, you know, whatever issue that he's pointing out? In this case, it was a burrowed animal hole of some sort. How big was the hole? How deep was it? Was it started? Was it? I don't know.
But is the rule for danger or is the
okay,
rule
but
for
here,
being impeded?
Well, you're taking everything into consideration.
They're taking everything, right?
But so, here's the thing, like to follow up on Matt's point, if a rules official comes in, sees that given the circumstance of where his ball is, where he is relative to the tree, how deep the hole is, takes everything into account, and then makes a statement that says that you should not have been given free relief from that type of drop, that means that the rules official, the subcontext there is he doesn't believe that burrowing hole is dangerous enough to impede whatever he has to hit as a shot.
To get it out, yeah.
So by definition, it should end right there.
Right. And again, like, and to give a bit more context on both sides of this, a hazard's a hazard, right? Like you put it in the water, you put it in a bunker.
That was my first conversation. That was my first point of like, if you're standing in the water or you're in a hazard, a hazard is a hazard.
And then the second thing that kind of came out of this is that he was eventually given relief and then he dropped it, but the ball kept rolling closer to the original hazard issue. So then eventually on the third drop after that, he gets to place it, right? So the issue now is, he gave himself a really good lie in theory by placing it.
No
so
kidding.
The issue is, A, you have your way with the rules official eventually, and B, a lot of people are saying, well, are they skilled enough to roll the ball off their fingers so that the ball does roll back towards the
original
issue?
I guarantee you players, when they're dropping the ball, they're manipulating how that drop takes place.
100%.
So you would have to be foolish not to
think
that's what's happening.
I think this is a whole...
Why wouldn't you?
But it's a whole...
And again, this has nothing to do with Xander. Like, I cannot stress enough, take him out of the equation here. We're just talking about any tour player and us. We would have done the same thing.
Well, no, it's the rules aren't being enforced. That's the reality. In the PGA...
I kind of like the idea that... How much of an asshole did the first rule official look like after the second rule official says yes?
Yeah, but
you basically just turned around to your colleague and said, no, you're wrong.
Right, whatever. I mean, again, you know, we're not trying to like spare people's feelings, but
an internal system that doesn't even agree with each other. I mean, so they're taking advantage.
I really like Brandon's idea, to be honest, of like when you call the first rules official in and it's set and the decision was made, if you don't like the decision and you're going to challenge it with someone else,
you should lose
there
something.
There needs to be some additional incentive there that penalizes you if that decision again doesn't come out in your favor.
Fair enough. But the idea that example, the purse at Waste was 20 million?
Yeah.
Okay. And they don't have a group of rules officials on each group on a Sunday afternoon.
But this is exactly.
But you can't afford it.
Of course they can afford it.
You're paying basically 60 people for 6 hours of work.
But that's what I'm saying.
That's 360 hours of work.
What is the training
and
the formation and how much, how empowered?
How also, like, how come other golfers in the same tournament who now Xander's outcome is affecting their pocket, how are they not allowed to challenge Xander's decision?
But here's the thing. Do you know how many?
Just like a sports team would counter challenge the coach.
Right. But
how come no one else is allowed to challenge him?
Because in theory, in golf, you're playing against the course. You're not playing against
your opponents. I understand that, but you're playing for money now.
But I think all of that, all those issues are eliminated if you enforce the rule already on the books. An example, like, and again,
well, we know that just doesn't happen.
But that's the thing, right? And problematic. Like, it's almost like the marketing department has more say over what rules are influenced or not, because, you know,
guys, it's not a surprise that the PGA Tour has always made decisions to protect their reputation of how they are as a tour.
Sure. And again, like, if you look at the Open or the US Open, they have rules officials with every group every day.
Yeah. Good luck getting one past the USGA.
By the way, I would have loved for this situation, and not actually have loved, but just in theory, I would have loved for this situation to have happened at the last event of the year. And imagine, because of what just took place and him getting that advantage on the free drop, gets up and down, saves a stroke because he didn't have to punch out. Even if he makes bogey, he could potentially be saving a stroke here, right? Imagine he saves a shot because of the free drop, earns a certain amount of money on the last event of the year, of the season, like at the Wyndham Championship or something, and someone else loses their tour status because of it. Could you imagine that happening there?
I'm sure it's happened before in the past. How many times has that happened?
You know
in
the how
past?
Crazy that would be if somebody like missed out on retaining PGA Tour status by like 5 FedEx Cup points on the last event of the year because someone else gets a free drop because he called in a second rules official. And imagine you being in that situation. Like, that's craziness.
I mean, this kind of thing happens in all sports. I keep reverting back to hockey.
I mean, the Super Bowl just ended on a referee call.
Yeah, Super Bowl just ended on that
on the last play of the game. Like,
but look at Formula One. How many? Like, just as an example, the championship, not last year, but the year before, where they allowed a certain amount of cars to get unlapped by the safety car, and then you had Max and Lewis fighting with only. But the rest of the.
I mean, the reality is Lewis loses that championship on a decision that Michael Massey made that shouldn't have happened.
Correct. So, my point is like the problem is not only the enforcement of rules, but it's the interpretation of rules. Now, when you leave the interpretation of rules up to one person, that's when you have an issue. The same issue happened in F1. The same issue happens now that you have one rules official. When they call over the rules official, and in my mind, for golf, especially since there's so much to take into consideration and it's a very subjective decision.
The first decision should be the last decision you're entitled to.
It's not just the last decision. It should be a group of people unanimously deciding. Okay, you call over the rules official. It should automatically be, let's say, 3 guys. So there's never...
But that's what the Open and the US Open do.
Thank you. And that works, right? You call over 3 guys. Whatever they say goes. And now, you know, because there's at least 3... Two of them have the majority decision on, like, they can't disagree. There's going to be an agreement one way or another. They come back to you with an answer.
I definitely
and that's
think
the answer. That's the interpretation.
I definitely think this has opened up a broader conversation that the rules need to change, or they need to be enforced differently, or the system in place needs to be structured differently.
It definitely needs
because
to be
if
the
these
system.
Types of things continue to happen, like, what are we doing here?
I don't think there's a problem with the rules. I don't think there's a problem with the players trying to take advantage of the rules. That's going to happen until the end of time. Anyone in any professional, anything.
The onus is on PGA. The onus
this has
is
nothing
on
to do with the player or how the rules agreed. being decided from the player's perspective.
Or the fact that the rules exist. The problem is your system of enforcing the rules is garbage.
It's on the
PGA. You have one person going out there and then you allow them to send another person. That makes no sense. It should be more than one person the first time. And it should the buck
could,
stops
could
there.
You imagine like a coach's challenge in the NHL, they don't like it, so they're like, no, let's throw in a second towel.
Can you imagine
a second coach's challenge?
Driving through a stop sign and a cop pulls you over and he comes
and they
to
go,
the window
no, bring a different cop
and he says no you ran a stop sign, I don't think I did, go get someone else to come and look at that. Get the guy that didn't see me going through the stop sign to come and give me a ticket. Oh, I don't get a ticket.
I mean, this comes down to the fact that like the decision was made and the system needs to change, that they can't bring in a second decision after the first decision was made.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going on and on, but yeah, we kind of all agree that the problem there is really just the enforcement and the PGA's system of enforcing the rules, I guess. for non-USG RNA. And,
I'm sure there's a lot of listeners right now who are going to say, you guys are off the rocker, or we good. Very tell us much why. Agree with everything.
What's your opinion? If you disagree with us, tell us so that we can come back and explain on the show why you're even more super wrong. So I have no problem putting any on the glass. The reality is
that
you have an opinion, right. Tell us. We'll share it. We'll even have you on the show maybe if it's strong enough.
Matt, it looks like you have a different conversation you want to bring up here.
Well, I just wanted to know, again, I don't know exactly when this is going to come out, but the Netflix show is coming out.
Oh, man. You know? I'm very excited for this. I'll say this. Okay. The first thing I was surprised. So this show is built by, is made by Netflix. The same team that did the Drive for Survive Formula 1.
Apparently, you can watch it, by the way. Yeah. If you log into some promo code that was released during the Super Bowl, you can watch it early.
I didn't. Yeah. I know you can watch the first. I heard you can watch the first episode
early.
Yeah,
exactly.
Sure. My initial reaction, why wasn't the golf show called Drive for Survive?
Yeah, it's true.
I don't get why they didn't give it the same name. It's an amazing name.
And I will say this. It's been proven mathematically that your strokes gained off the tee is very highly valuable these days. So it literally could be said Drive to Survive.
I was watching an interview of Jordan Spieth talking about the show. And they were asking him if he's going to watch it. And one thing he did say that was interesting was that a lot of last year, everyone knows that what went down with Liv and all the golfers kind of like, you know, the whole professional golf world basically like fracturing in two. And he said that he wouldn't be interested to kind of watch like random golfers in their house. He's like, I don't want to see guys at home with their wives. Like, I don't really care what's going on there. But he goes, it'll give guys a chance to kind of tell their version of the story as to what happened with Liv and what's going on. Because I think a lot of people just assumed. They didn't really get a lot of the information. So I think there's going to be a good story breakdown there.
Wait, you're saying that people actually judge things just based on the surface of what they're reading in a headline on Twitter?
People basically take Twitter to be the Bible. But so I think that's going to be interesting for the show. The second thing I'm very excited is for, and this is coming from someone who's been a golf fan all of his life, as well as a Formula One fan all of my life. I've always been an F1 fan ever since I was a kid, watching it on Sundays. And the show definitely brought a ton of eyes to the sport and a lot of interest. It wasn't just superficial.
You're referring to F1 at this current moment.
Formula One. It wasn't superficial interest. I've made a lot of friends recently who have gotten into Formula One and who have like really gotten into it. They've become fans of teams. They're really invested.
I know people
in
golf, by the way, who are huge Formula One fans now because of the show.
Because of the show. And I think COVID was the first big step of growth in the last 10 years for golf. Unfortunately, as bad as that sounds, COVID definitely got a lot of people into golf, people who never golfed before, because that was the only thing you can do. And I think this show is going to be another driving factor for newcomers to the sport. And to be honest, that's good, because I think there's a lot of old, dusty, I don't know, the golf world feels and smells old and dusty.
I think we need to get rid of a lot of the gatekeepers.
We need to open the windows up and just let the breeze through.
We need to get rid of some of these old gatekeepers on some of these old things.
And I think this show is going to bring more of that.
There's a lot of
musty old basement smell.
Yeah,
of golf.
I know, but there's a lot of new versions of what golf is right now
which
might not be super accessible to a lot of people that don't try to find it, which is great and exciting. But I think the production value that they brought to the F1 made it exciting. It's already obviously an exciting sport.
There's obviously a lot of like forced drama that, as an F1 fan watching the season, you can kind of tell where they forced the issue a little bit.
On the drama that's not really there in real life. Yeah, but that's fine.
But that's kind of like scraping TV. You know, like but we know, someone who's just watching for the first time, they need a hook.
But I have friends that aren't golf fans at all. Per se, they don't golf. They don't really consume golf other than like the stuff that overflows into mainstream culture. But a lot of them saw the teaser and they were just like, oh, wow. Like, I might not start golfing, but I'll definitely watch the show.
Oh, absolutely.
You know what I mean? Like they definitely seem to have packaged it in a way that's going to be like, you know, digested and watched in an entertaining way, which I think a lot of golf can be like, if you know, like, man, I'll wake up on a Thursday and watch Eurotour stuff. Like, you know, that's dry. Like that's dry stuff. You know, that's not for everybody.
The announcing is very dry sometimes, but I'll tell you what, if you're a golf fan, like,
but that's what I'm saying, right? But for people that I know that aren't golf people at all and who will probably never golf, they're anecdotally into, you know, watching the show. They're like, yeah, when it comes out, I will definitely watch it.
Am I just the biggest asshole, by the way, that I'm just not that excited to watch the show?
I think that's because you know too much about golf already. Like, there's no reason for you to watch it.
But you're
aware of all the storytelling they're going
to
do.
I see that the audience that they're trying to grab, and I because I'm so but
that's
far,
not you.
Exactly. Like, I'm so far away from that type of
but
audience.
But I share
because
that.
I'm so in the inner circle of what goes on that, like, it just doesn't excite me to watch it.
But that's the thing. I share a bit of that. You know, I saw the preview and I was like, oh, this is a lot of fluff. I mean, I get it. It's cool.
But again, both of you, and I'll put myself in the same boat, is like we're in the golf world to some degree. So like the storytelling and the audience they're trying to hook with this is not us because we know these stories.
Oh, am I going to watch it? Absolutely.
Like, I'll say one thing. I have a lot of friends for a long time who like didn't really believe how hard a Formula One driver has to work. You know what I mean? Like, what level of physical athlete?
I mean,
they
I can
are.
Recall us being in conversations, Brandon, when we were younger,
with
some friends that used to tell you F1 isn't even a sport; they're not athletes.
And I'm sure there's people out there listening to this who still kind of believe the same thing. It's just a car. Well, you know what? Watch Drive to Survive, and then tell me after watching the entire series how hard these guys work to just forget winning, to just keep their ass in that seat. How much they need to work, and I think it's going to do the same for golf. A lot of people who don't golf have this impression. That golf is kind of like a...
Oh, yeah. They're going
to
pull
the
curtains.
That's the old man smell that you're referring
to. Retirement sport. And you know what? Watch this show and you're going to see how goddamn hard these guys work. Again, not even just to win, but just to keep their name
on
that list.
But I hope they cover those, like, you know, top 50 guys, top 60 guys. Like, I hope that they really pull the curtain back on, like, what the actual grind is for the non-top 25.
There's a really good Instagram account. I think it's a page just reposting their Twitter feed. So it's probably a Twitter account called Monday Q Info.
Yeah. I know the guy. His name is Ryan French.
So I don't personally.
He started covering like Monday qualifiers.
This guy is doing, I think, in my opinion, like Mother Teresa's work for golf because he is.
Well, he's
out
brought
there.
More eyes on the mini tours and the golfers.
But that's it.
The non-rich top 50.
So
top
for those of you
guys.
Who don't know, this guy basically posts all of like the best and amazing.
I could be mistaken, by the way, but I believe his name is Ryan French.
Positive and negative stories that come out of like Monday qualifying for any like tour event, whether it be for mini tours, whether it be for a developmental tour. So that's like Mackenzie Tour, that's like Korn Ferry, that's like Challenge, whatever, and then Monday qualifiers for for tour events. Like, there's some of these like amazing storylines that come out of this guy's page. Let me see his account there. You're showing me on your phone. Yeah, it's called Monday Q Info. So on Twitter, it's A Case of the Golf.
Brandon, I can assure you every single person listening to this podcast probably knows who this guy is.
Okay, well, whoever isn't, go out on Twitter, go on Instagram and just search Monday Q Info. Just some really heartwarming stories about how guys like, you know, battle their way onto a tournament or into a field. Some ridiculous stories of how they got, you know, how they didn't make the cut. And it kind of just goes along the lines of what you're saying, Matt, about like, I hope the show kind of highlights a little bit of like not only the highs and lows of the top level guys, but also like the absolute turmoil and struggle and trudge in the mud. It is the grind. People don't realize how hard it is to become a pro golfer. Like, man, you could be on that grind for 20, 30 years before you even get a chance to break it into a dev tour. Like,
hey, man,
it's nuts.
If you look at the numbers, what is it, Shane? Top 400 guys in the world technically sort of make a living? Sort of?
Oh, I'm willing to bet it's probably less than that.
How many pro golfers are there on PGA, Euro, Challenge, and Korn Ferry? So the top four, let's say.
PGA Tour, like actual active members that compete in full-time schedules?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's probably like 200.
Yeah.
Then Korn Ferry?
Probably about the same.
So let's say on average, we average
175 to 200. So let's say 400 between PGA, Korn Ferry.
And then same thing over.
And then Euro Tour, same thing. So like maybe. And there's a lot of intersecting there.
So
let's
you're
say
talking
like
800 guys.
500. No, even less. 500.
Yeah. If you take the top if you take the top 500 golfers in the world, that it's their full-time job.
Yeah.
You know, Monday
for
to
sure.
Friday. Most of them don't make a comfortable living.
No.
No, the only ones who do are like PGA and European Tour.
Like if you look at the top 75, top 80, make real good
PGA
money.
PGA Tour, European Tour, man, that's it.
Yeah.
Korn Ferry Tour, I mean, the money winner every
only
year
now
is
on
what,
the
like
Korn
300,000?
Ferry, they guaranteed a certain, only guaranteed, now, like it's next season starting, the guarantee for the Korn Ferry if you're full-time status?
What do you mean?
What was it that they had the PGA, who, that Jay or someone had announced that the Korn Ferry, if you have full-time status on Korn Ferry, you're making a certain amount
of you're guaranteed a certain amount of money. Yeah, I think they released, this is the first year I think they're doing that.
Which is like, about time.
You earn a minimum of a certain amount for the year, and if you don't earn that over the year, they cover the difference.
So it's similar to the live structure where you have to basically, like, if you win it, you get it, but if you don't win it, they'll pay it.
Is that what they're doing on the live? I'm not even aware of that.
Well, I mean, the stories are kind of coming out now that a lot of these like signing bonuses for LIV were not really what they thought. It was kind of like,
okay, well, I know that's what they're doing for the PGA Tour. So if that's what they were already doing on LIV, then yeah, similar.
Well, it's good because I think a lot of the problem that that pro golf has is accessibility. Like, you have these guys flying around on their own dollar. You have them paying to enter the tournament, and then they're barely making their money back.
The PGA Tour only released this for the Korn Ferry, correct?
Yeah.
They're not covering any losses for Latin America.
I don't think so.
China, Canada.
I think it's only Korn Ferry.
Right.
Just to give you so for some of the people listening, the person who had mentioned this to us, so Etienne Bro, which is a coach at our golf studio and a professional golfer who Shine coaches many years on the McKenzie, was excited about this because, you know, his career path is to make it to the Korn Ferry and to the PGA. And, the stories he was telling us about how expensive it is, you know, even on the McKenzie Tour to pay yourself, travel, pay your stay, pay to enter the tournament, and then even winning the tournament like almost barely covers your expenses. And for you to transition from McKenzie to Korn Ferry, you basically need like the heater of your life in terms of a hot streak to get up and guarantee yourself a spot in the Korn Ferry Tour. And then even there, for the longest time, it was like, you know, barely make it or break it. So,
well, here's the problem with PGA Tour Canada is there's only 12 tournaments on the schedule every year, and they were only giving out at the time for a long time 5 cards to Korn Ferry,
which is crazy. How many golfers are on the McKenzie?
Same thing like everything else, 150, 175,
which is crazy.
So you have 150 to 175 players. There is one out of every, let's be safe and say one out of every 30 to 40 is getting a tour card at the end of the year. And those who even do that, they earn maybe 100K at most by the end of the year. And that's the best of the whole field. Most of them average out at the end of the season to what, like 20, 30, 40,000? Like, it's something horrible. They make less than the minimum wage over the course of the year, and they have travel expenses.
20, 30, or 40,000. So imagine with $40,000, you have to travel and stay to 12 different locations.
Across Canada.
Across Canada. Not the cheapest place to fly. Imagine.
Yeah, it's a tough tour.
It's a grind. It's a money loss. If you don't have a sponsor, like, good luck.
Yeah.
I mean, put it this way. I'm looking at some numbers right now. The entire 2021 season, so pretty fresh, pretty new, the total prize purse for the season was $700,000.
That's, I mean,
so divide that by 12. Whatever it is, 8 events, 10 events, even let's say 10 events, right? It's an average of a $70,000 prize purse.
Just to put that into consideration, TrackMan recently started their next tour. So for those who don't know, the next tour is a professional, actually open to all, I guess, league. I don't know what I would call it. Tour by TrackMan. You pay to enter. It's $130 US to enter the tournament. Anybody, professional or amateur, can join as a professional and amateur. And the prize pool, I think, per tournament is already... What was the payout for the last one? I think it was like close to $20,000. Price pool for the whole for the one event was how much? You remember?
Oh, per event, it's hitting about 150K because they have 100,000 of sponsorship backing per event plus 50K in entry fees that are going in.
So you basically...
So just for the record, the biggest prize purse on the McKenzie Tour last year was 225 grand. So the next tour event, a one-day tournament with zero travel because you're doing it on a simulator, had basically...
Zero stay, zero car rental.
Yeah, had basically like 75% of the value of the purse of the McKenzie Tour last year. And it's a one-day tournament with no expenses.
This is amazing because this type of event... Is
by the way, like, nobody knows about the next golf tour. Like, well, everybody I talk to has no idea.
People are
going to
start knowing now.
Yeah, even professional golfers, they have no clue.
Sorry?
It's a great development tool, especially for Etienne, like, for him to be able to... to play in the winter here.
Well, I mean, it gives him a little bit of a continuation on his competition without having to travel somewhere else.
Sure.
And he's been making money in every
My point is not even that. It's almost finishers. It's almost if the next tour continues on the path that they're continuing with the growth that they have in four events, I've already seen how big the fields have gotten. Like, I mean, you're going to start pushing with the like tours like the McKenzie. I mean, he has to pay zero to go anywhere. So he's at home. He wakes up. He comes to our studio. He joins the tournament. He plays his round. He doesn't have to pay for a flight, for a hotel, for food. He earns himself in the money, and then he goes home. It costs him $0, and he walks away with pure profit. Okay, it's not actually playing. It's playing virtual golf, but the point is, at the end of the day, what's the goal of a pro golfer? Is it to play virtual and real golf, or real golf, or is it to make money? It's to make.
Well, I think for a certain group of aspirational players, that fills a gap. I mean,
for
I think
sure.
It's great.
Are you kidding me?
You know, it's an obvious great idea to grow entries into career golf.
I'm just excited to see this push the mini tours.
But do you think
into having maybe bigger purses, because they obviously. And I don't know if it's because of a lack of funding, and if it is a lack of funding that's coming from the top, then maybe this will open their eyes to do something like this, because you're going to start losing, you know. I had an interesting conversation with someone about the potential of this tour, maybe even down the line, giving pro golfers access to some of the bigger tours. So like, I can see how you'll start seeing a shift away from. Some of the smaller mini tours into this virtual tour. At the end of the day, if you can play on the virtual tour, pay way less, earn just as much, if not more, and then somehow down the line, earn your way a card into an actual
Big tour. Yeah, of course. I'm actually surprised.
Oh, man, why would anyone want to go the McKenzie route?
But I'm surprised that like Topgolf hasn't dipped their toes.
It's gonna come.
Dip their toes into some sort of a money based.
Trackman's the first to do it right now, I think. And if I'm mistaken, leave us a comment and tell us where else that they're doing something like this. But I wouldn't be surprised at all whatsoever if you see the big Top Trace companies doing exactly this. So Topgolf, Top Tracer.
I mean, it's an
Foresight.
No-brainer.
I wouldn't be surprised in the least if you see these like professional leagues coming out of there.
First of all, isn't there the TGR or whatever it is coming out that's like the Topgolf stuff with Tiger and Max Homa? Obviously, it's kind of like a big name exhibition.
Yeah.
That's still on.
But they're coming out. But they're coming out with like a league based on it for them.
Yeah.
And isn't it at Topgolf?
I think so. It's like a Monday night thing.
Yeah.
Sort of like that. I mean, I don't know a lot about it. I've already read like the headlines and stuff, but I'm curious to see what it's gonna turn into.
But I wouldn't be surprised if you start getting these like massive leagues, paid competitions.
I think that'd be cool. Like, I mean, I think that'd be cool. I think there's
you
a big
pay to enter and there's a winning.
I think there's a big disconnect worldwide for feeder systems for professional golf. Obviously, in the States, they have the NCAA as a route for professional golf. Obviously they have a few feeder tours, but generally speaking, like there's a lot of talent out there that has a hard time just finding the access to get to, you know, a career as a golfer.
It's sad to say, but it's really a pay to play kind of sport. Like you look at other sports.
Well, in North America, a lot more, obviously there's parts of the world too, where aren't, but example, like Europe is, I mean, I guess it's probably changed quite a bit in Europe now because a lot of big colleges go scout players out there. But like in the 90s, it was a lot different. Like in the 90s, young talent in Europe, I mean, some of them went to American colleges, but a lot of them just played their development golf there and made it through, you know, what is the Euro Tour now, but what it was then, right?
Yeah. I still think it has a long way to go. You look at other global sports like, and maybe this is a poor example, but like soccer. Man, right. You can get scouted.
Sure,
you know,
sure,
off
but
your street.
But you know, I mean,
yeah, it's a bad example. But just to say, like, I'd like to see golf.
I think this is
making golf more accessible, right?
But here's my first attempt at a segue. That being said, if it's a governance issue, if you were governor for a day.
If I was what PGA what?
Yeah, if you were the if you were Jay. Jay for a day.
If I was Jay for a day,
what would you do to address accessibility for you know feeder systems? Because it's not clear to me what it is right now that it's super efficient.
I'm not sure if this is something that's already being done. I know that, for example, anyone can play in a qualifier for the U.S. Open, right?
Right, but again, like,
but that's the USGA.
But that's a small thing, and that's USGA. But I just
I'm saying is, if I was Jay, and I wanted to address accessibility to professional golf, mm-hmm. is this the question you're asking?
Well, no, I mean to create a place where you're going to get the best golfers in the world come on your tour, because you're obviously going to start competing against other tours. Like, as an example, which I think is incredibly problematic, is if you look at the Champions Tour, the purses that they get at the Champions Tour, I think it's bananas. Like, how is it that the Korn Ferry, you know, outside of the top 10, top 15 on the Korn Ferry, these guys are paying out of their pocket to play golf professionally. And then you go to the Champions Tour and these guys are playing for millions of dollars.
It boggles my mind, even just thinking about, like,
look at the LPGA,
like college sports and like the whole new NIL thing with NCAA and how athletes can start getting paid now. And like, there's some mega contracts out there for guys still in school.
Yeah.
And yet on the Korn Ferry, guys are struggling to even get their name like noticed by any sponsor. And these are guys in the top 20, top 30 on the Korn Ferry, and I bet you most people listening don't even know these guys' names.
I hate the arguments that I read people say online of like, oh, now that these players are earning such big guaranteed money is that they have no incentive to perform. Like, isn't that the case in every sport everywhere already? Like, a guy does really well in the NHL, signs a massive contract, but you're telling me for the next 10 years he's just never going to perform? They still do.
Yeah, but the beauty about sports that these people don't realize is that it's a democratic process. If you stop performing, guess what, bud? You ain't there anymore.
Well, to a certain degree. Yeah, for most people, yes. Not all.
Fine, fair. And I'm sure some of those other people bring other things to the sport, which is why they stay there.
Sure.
Right? Whether you suck or not, your name's been there for a long time. There's a lot of golfers like that.
It depends what sport you're referring to right now.
There's a lot of sports where not the best guy brings a lot of money to the sport and stays relevant for a long time. That's never going to change because their name is attached to a certain amount of revenue that the sport generates.
Like Ricky Fowler?
Like, I'm not going to name names. You guys can do that. But
honestly, I was actually thinking more along the lines of like an F1 driver who brings a ton of sponsorship revenue.
But these are two good examples. But just to say, I think at the end of the day, that argument of like, oh, well, if you get paid too much, you're not going to perform is bullshit. Because first of all, the biggest reason why pro athletes get into their sport is because of their passion for the sport. How many cases do we see of guys making a shit ton of money and they still go on to become super dominant, super amazing athletes?
And that's my point. I don't believe in the argument that just because you're getting paid a lot of money, exactly, you lose incentive to work.
No, I don't.
And if you sit back after earning a paycheck,
there's going to be some percentage of people who might not want to anymore, but I don't think that's the majority at all.
Yeah, I don't think that's a valid argument. And I guess the case could be made for like specific cases, but that's neither here nor there. But I mean, I think the economics of it all is that if you can put asses in seats, you should get paid.
Yeah.
That's that.
Yeah, but at the same time,
that's a tough line.
Well, that's the thing. If you put asses in the seats,
but that's a tough take, because I think certain governing bodies of certain sports dictate how accessible you are to people to be interested.
Oh no, but there's tons of
layers. How many amazing Korn Ferry golfers are there that they're charismatic, they have personality, that they would sell, their name would be amazing.
Even lower hanging fruit. There's
storylines.
Some of the best professional golfers in the world that blow me away day in, day out, LPGA.
Yeah.
And they make a fraction of what their tour generates.
And what's the reason?
I don't know. I mean, again, like, there's probably like a governance.
Accessibility and marketing.
Yeah,
you put enough marketing behind the LPGA, you're going to generate as much interest as any other sport.
Fair enough.
Yeah. I hate the... I read sometimes on the internet people saying like, oh, if the LPGA had more interest, it would have more revenue. I disagree with that. And I'll give you an example. When I used to work for the Liquor Commission, we used to sell bottles of champagne. Bottles of champagne that sell by far the most are nowhere near the best quality. They are the ones that have by far the most marketing juiced into them all the time.
Of course.
Yeah.
Every single time.
But like anything.
So my point being, if you put the money behind the sport will have, like Brandon's saying, the viewership would grow, the revenue would grow.
Sure, but it's like input-output, right? I mean, but again, like...
But there is no input into the LPGA.
With marketing dollars comes exposure and storylines. With exposure and storylines generates interest, and then interest puts asses in seats.
Oh, no, I know, absolutely. I don't think it's just one thing. I think those are all things that
happen. The problem with the LPGA is that they make it
they it's almost by design, like a poorly marketed product. It's not interesting. There's no
story. I will say, by the way, Mike Wan, who was the long-term LPGA commissioner, has done wonders.
Yeah.
From what I've heard and from the inner circle, he was an incredible commissioner and has only made it get better. But I do believe there's still a lot of work to make it.
But I disagree with you that it's not as interesting. I mean,
I'm not saying that it's not interesting for you. I'm saying it's not interesting in, like, for someone who's
It doesn't have a platform.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's truly a world tour. It's truly international, unlike the PGA.
It's more international than the PGA Tour.
Yeah.
Like they play more events outside of the US than the PGA Tour does, and it's not even close.
Yeah. Yeah,
and this issue exists in a lot of sports for women. I think that there's, you know, they say that it doesn't generate as much revenue. I think they're just not given the chance to. I really believe that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't follow.
I feel like we can like bring in tennis. 17 different arguments. I feel like tennis for that.
But look at tennis. You have Serena. They put money. I mean, there's a platform for Serena to exist, and then she puts asses in seats, and people love it.
It's true.
By the way, Wimbledon pays out the same amount for a major championship.
There you go.
For men and women.
Is that recent?
That's a great question. I do not have the answer on that, but I know for a fact as of right now.
If it is recent, that's...
If I'm not mistaken, I remember reading that Wimbledon pays their winners, men and women, the same amount every year.
Well, we can Google that, I guess. But if that's the case to be recent, I would say that's the Serena effect. If that's not the case to be recent, then that is some damn good commissioning, I guess you could say, by whoever was doing that. Because look at how popular tennis is on both sides, for men and for women. I don't feel like there's one side that's more popular than the other. Maybe there's more characters coming out of the men's side, but I think women's tennis is just as popular.
Released in July 2022 by the Daily Mail. In Grand Slam tournaments like the Wimbledon, the U.S. Open, and the French Open, male and female winners will receive the same amount of prize money. So that's pretty crazy, but that is pay equality, or at the bare minimum, getting closer to that.
Yeah,
which I'm happy about.
Anyway, on that note, I think we covered a lot of topics. I don't want to overextend our episode just because
there's so many more.
Yeah, well, let's save some for the next roundtable that we have. I think we filled our listeners' heads with a lot of ideas and probably heated them up enough to be yelling at the speakers right now. But hopefully you guys enjoyed our first episode back. This was really a taste of what's going to be coming. A little more casual conversation like you just experienced. Take on recent events and stuff like that. We're going to have, if you have more topics you want us to debate or you want us to tackle, leave it in the comments on our Instagram page. Tell us what you want to hear. Tell us what you don't like hearing. Tell us where you think you disagree with us or where we're wrong. And we'll come and tell you why we're right.
Just a refresher, we're going to still be hosting our one-on-one interviews that I've been doing in the past. I'll be doing that again. We have a list of like 50 people waiting to be interviewed. Yeah. It's going to be amazing. Yeah.
We're going to have a good year for
interviews. So those one-on-one informative ones are still going to continue to exist. And then we're going to have this second pod that's going to be released all the time as well.
And just, again, last thing is that on this second show, we don't have a name yet. Matt and I and Shaheen are still kind of ping-ponging names around.
And just to clarify, both versions of the show will be on the same, under the same.
Correct.
Yeah.
So the How's My Hand Path umbrella will have both shows. Shaheen's show with interviews.
I mean, technically my show, I guess if you're putting it that way, it doesn't have a name either, right?
Well, yours is the original.
It's your show.
Here's our public discussion.
I know it's going to be your show, but I'm going to insist on being on some of them.
Yeah, that's all right. I mean, to be fair, I would want both of you guys there for some of the people that we're going to be interviewing. I think you guys might come up with better questions than I would. So, I'm just a golf coach, man. I just teach people how to hit a little white ball across an open field.
Well, I think you're underselling it.
Anyway, the idea is we're going to have two shows, one a little more technical focused and then one a little more loose. So whatever that evolves into, hopefully you guys enjoy. Tell us how we can improve. Leave us some feedback. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. 5-star if you can. If not, tell us why not 5-star. We love you all. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Matt, for joining us as our third host officially on the show and for doing such a great job.
Well, you know, thank you.
All right, folks. On that note, peace.
Have a good one.